Our next speaker is Jill Reese. Jill joined the faculty of Portland State University in 2009 as an assistant professor of public administration, where she teaches in the MPH and MPA programs. After starting her career as an emergency department staff nurse, Dr. Reese spent 8 years in county government, first as a budget management analyst and later as a health system administrator. From 1999 to 2009, she worked as a senior foundation executive in her hometown of Phoenix, Arizona, overseeing the organization's administrative and financial operations before becoming its first director of health system research and policy. While in Arizona, she taught graduate level courses in health policy as an adjunct faculty member and served on numerous local boards and committees, including the State Medicaid Advisory Committee, Maricopa County Audit Committee, Governor's Philanthropy Roundtable, and Nurses Association Board of Directors, among others. She's conducted numerous research projects, most recently directing a statewide health survey addressing insurance coverage, physical and mental health status, social and environmental determinants of health, and other topics. Dr. Reese received a PhD from the School of Public Affairs at Arizona State University, where her research focused on deliberative models of democratic governance and health policy. In addition to a master's in public administration, Dr. Reese holds undergraduate degrees in physiological psychology and nursing. Jill.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and gosh, being of small stature, I hope you can like see my head bobbing above the screen here. I'm back here. Anyway, what I'm going to talk about today is actually some of the work that stems from my interest and focus on deliberative democracy and how deliberation, how health system reform might play out or is playing out, and what we can kind of learn about that from deliberative forums. So over the next 15 to, I guess, maybe 20 minutes, I'm going to cover kind of five things. First, I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about the kind of the concept of deliberative democracy and the goals of the project. Then really a brief overview of the deliberative forums that were the basis for this research. And then we'll look at just briefly the shift in public preferences so you can kind of see how they did change. And really want to focus more on how then those deliberative outcomes were achieved. Why did people change their minds? So first of all, there's this normative ideal of deliberative democracy that rests on three primary principles. First of all is participation. And oftentimes deliberative forums, there's this ideal that they should be broadly inclusive. That really is a little more consistent with hearings, with forums, with voting behaviors, and then giving rise to this notion of political space, not necessarily the state house or legislative chambers, but really a socially constructed space. Where people can express ideas in more of an Aristotelian conception of democracy. This then in turn gives rise to this notion of public judgment, which we contrast with mass opinion, which is oftentimes what we get out of polls and surveys and some of the challenges with their lack of predictive value for then future behaviors. And thus public judgment is kind of given this kind of normative ideal as being more stable, more representative, and able then to predict further how people will actually behave when given the opportunity to consider the trade-offs that are inherent in value-laden kinds of issues. So why study deliberative democracy? Why in healthcare? Well, first of all, there's really been very little research about the mechanisms underlying deliberative outcomes. You continually see these shifts from the work that was done with the America Speaks forums, work that's been done in other states. You frequently see people shifting their opinions about their preferences for the types of either market or more publicly oriented reforms that they want. If they want single payers, if they want the whole notion of this public option, pre-existing conditions, all of these different things, how people view healthcare. Of course, the perpetual system in crisis in the healthcare system itself. Again, surveys and polls measure, but they oftentimes don't reconcile the conflicts. They can show that there's a fair amount of dissatisfaction, concerns about cost, concerns about quality. But because they're a permanent one-way kinds of conversations, they don't really allow people to kind of consider the trade-offs. Oftentimes, particularly like for phone surveys, not to, pick on any one particular kind, but people don't really consider in that space of a few seconds, they say, you know, B. But when they actually get to that point in life and having to make a choice and have to really more carefully consider the trade-offs that are inherent in it, that doesn't really allow them to resolve sometimes even their own personal conflicts about these choices that we see between cost, between quality and access. Finally, this notion of this black box of deliberation, why do people's opinions change? How we can increase the understanding and then kind of help restore this balance between oftentimes what we, you know, I say we, myself included, as the director of a large-scale statewide survey, kind of come in as the experts with the answers and say this is what we ought to do. Oftentimes that's based on cost-effectiveness or cost-benefit, other kinds of economic analyses, and not really sensitive to the meaning of those numbers in the context of people's lives. So the research design here, just briefly, a series of three public dialogues, about 40 people in each who were randomly selected and demographically representative, about 6 to 8 hours. So you can see beyond the traditional two-hour forum or hearing where people get up, kind of say their piece, and then, you know, sit down. This was really very interactive. From that, I had the empirical materials, which were the tapes, audio and video tapes, transcripts, and some questionnaires that people filled out both before in order to gauge their preferences, as well as after the series of dialogues, which is how we measured the shift in preferences, as well as then had some additional information about broader demographics and experience with the healthcare system. The research questions themselves were pretty broad. This was fairly exploratory. Like I said, there's not much in the literature on this, on deliberative forums and how these outcomes are changed. And so the methods of inquiry, like I said, the statistical analysis where you could measure the shift in preferences, but it was really largely qualitative, which you don't see a whole lot in healthcare, looking at really the narrative and the content analysis. So rudimentary conceptual framework. People kind of start on the left side of the graph here where you can see with their personal experience and their current knowledge and understanding. So the Massachusetts experience, they have their own experience of healthcare and what they read in the media and what they're hearing. And so you have knowledge and experience, which is, excuse me, which is pretty much what shapes their current opinions and their current preferences, what they know and understand about the healthcare system. To that, we add this notion of new information and deliberation so that we see this shift in preferences. So this is kind of where we started. So you can have a better understanding of the background of these forums themselves because it's kind of important for the context. These are the four scenarios that they gauged in that initial preference questionnaire. You can see here they're kind of along two dimensions, employer-based versus public as the source of coverage, and then comprehensive versus limited really as the level of benefit. They rated each on a scale of 1 to 10. And then these kind of two main questions, how do you want to get your coverage and what should be covered, then became the basis for large and small group discussions. Once they had kind of come to consensus around that, we gave them lunch and sent them back and said, okay, and then the final question is, how do you want to pay for it? Which is really then the real trade-off that needs to be considered. And at the end of the day, of course, then they were then again asked to rate each of the scenarios or create a little bit of a hybrid. So as you can see here, these are the results. So you can see the shift in preferences. I would point your attention first to the two sets of bars on the left, which really shows that what they kind of were considering and kind of keying on first is what was covered. The two comprehensive scenarios rated, scored most highly at 6.7 and 6.1, again, on a scale of 1 to 10. And then by the end of the day, they were really switching kind of their focus and their discussion from what was covered to how they would get their coverage. And you see this shift then to going from this initial comprehensive private system on the far left to a comprehensive public system, but then a slightly more limited benefit, still public system on the far right, followed just shortly behind that. So we saw this real shift from comprehensive to slightly more limited benefits, and I'll talk about some of the reasons for that in just a minute, but as well as this major shift from private insurance as the primary source of coverage, the employer-based system that everybody, you know, knows and loves, to a more publicly oriented system. Although I'll have to say that they, while they wanted a publicly oriented system, they saw it as a quasi-governmental system. Again, these were done in Arizona. There's not a lot of regard for the legislature in Arizona. People, we oftentimes refer to them as the 90 dwarves. And so they saw it really more as a public utility or as a workers' comp, which would have its own then separately elected kind of an oversight board and would then maintain the source of funding for it, which they saw as a combination of taxes, and they went there in a heartbeat. Everything from sin taxes to employer taxes to personal income taxes with a floor and a ceiling. So it was really actually very pragmatic and very balanced in terms of how they would imagine paying for it. But that's not my point today. My point today is to talk about why they changed their minds. Why did they go from a comprehensive private system to more of a public and somewhat a little bit more limited in terms of its benefits? Key point underlying that was this concept of personal responsibility and balancing that with equity and fairness and watching them kind of work through these trade-offs. So three dimensions really emerged that seem to be the most important: process, content, and participants. Process and content have been fairly well addressed in the literature already. The process itself, saying that it needs to be somewhat structured, and again, cover each of these a little bit more in a minute, but really what was new here was this notion of participants. Beyond this this concept of kind of broad participation in terms of democracy, what that meant in terms of the participants themselves and their identity. So talking about each of these just real quickly. With regard to process, some of the things that were really important were the background materials, that they were balanced. Oftentimes something that is a pro argument for one notion, when you're looking at public and private kinds of sources of coverage, can become a con for the other. And so it became a real challenge to make sure that the materials that they were provided before the dialogues were quite well balanced, so as to not really skew or set up some sort of a preconceived preference for their discussions. The physical environment itself as well. Oftentimes, like you see in hearings and forums, you'll have the legislature, the city council, the mayor, the administrator, kind of up in front, at the front of the room, you know, behind a podium, behind a table, speaking as an expert. These dialogues were purposely set up such that everybody sat kind of on equal footing. There was a little bit of the front of the room that was mainly to accommodate the audio and videotaping, so that people could see what was going on. But beyond that, the chairs were set in a circular fashion. So you had this kind of symbolic notion of everybody comes in here on equal footing, which, as we'll see later, was important as well. The role of the facilitators was huge. Beyond providing some explanation and had some expertise about the background materials, they did two things that were really important. They kept the discussions going, and one of the most important things that they did in terms of being professionally facilitated in these large groups was that they modeled ways of challenging each other's kind of statements. We've sometimes lost a little bit of our capacity for our civic discourse, as we see when we're hearing in forums people saying, liar. It's like, no, we don't do that. There are ways of challenging what somebody is saying without being conflicting. You know, the moderators, when you could see kind of the body language, somebody would be speaking, and you know, the people, you can't see, you know, me behind here, but the people you could kind of see, you could kind of read their body language, that they were not accepting this argument, that nobody was going to say anything, because they didn't know kind of how to challenge that. And so the facilitators were able to model kind of the, well, tell me more about that. Or we heard this over here, now you're saying that. It seems that those don't work well together. Can you tell me how we'd reconcile those? And so the facilitators really played a role that the participants themselves would then pick up, so that they then could turn to the other person and say, well, I don't understand that. Tell me more about it, as opposed to saying, you know, I think you're like way off base here. So they were able to model that. Could also be a little bit of a constraint, sometimes generated a little bit of resistance when they got a little bit too heavy-handed with their moderating. So it was, that was kind of an interesting thing to watch. But the final thing here about process was that engagement and participation were really not the same. Like I said, the people were recruited, so they were demographically representative. They were paid actually a pretty decent stipend, $125, to come and show up, because otherwise you lose your high end, you know, $10 in a water bottle my whole Saturday, I don't think so. So they were paid a fair stipend so that you maintained your demographics, particularly at the upper income levels. But beyond that, the fact that they were all there, they had this real difference that engagement was not the same as participation. And most interestingly, it was not related to their shift in preferences. We were able to identify individuals and to see where they started, how strongly did they want a private market-oriented comprehensive system. And did they shift? How far did they shift? So we were able to quantify that and then went back and looked at the degree to which they spoke, to which they listened, to which they were engaged in the discussion, and there was no relation. So we thought that was actually quite interesting, that people were listening and taking in a lot of this change and debate and discussion, even if they themselves did not speak a great deal, and or may or may not have been influential when they did. So we found kind of an interesting disconnect there. Obviously exploratory, a lot more to unpack there. But moving on to content, again, the background information being quite balanced. At the time I was working for the foundation, and you know, much to our chagrin, we spent a lot of money doing actuarial analysis of those four scenarios so that we actually knew what the cost would be and tried to present that in a very balanced way. And what was very interesting was that in their discussions and this notion of narratives telling stories versus presenting reasoned arguments, and particularly in the presentation of, you know, factual data, is that they didn't look at that actuarial analysis and all of the dollars. That wasn't the cost of these scenarios, which were all priced out based on Arizona's uninsured population and who would be picked up in what markets according to which scenario and how they got their coverage. They hardly looked at it. So it's like, oh, well, that's $25,000 not well spent, but okay. because it really wasn't important. It was an important place to start. But when they talked about cost, they really talked about it in the meaning of somebody's lives. When they talked about COBRA coverage, you lose your job, you lose your coverage. Oh, well, you've got COBRA. Well, but COBRA costs me, blah, blah, blah. But the point was, and it's kind of what brings us to our final point, which is the participants themselves. The fact that you were hearing this argument from a person you had had this discussion with for a number of hours and had come to know and see as a credible, reasonable person whose experience differed from one's own, that's what made the difference. They didn't care if it was $120 or $150 per person. What they cared about was, you know, this person in particular, their family, their situation, because they then became credible, not some kind of amorphous other. So this notion of identity that people came in with and kind of how it evolved, they first, you know, walked in like us here in this room, and we're kind of a bunch of people, we know we have a few things in common, but beyond that, beyond knowing kind of why we're here, we don't know much about each other. That really changed and evolved, and people's identities then evolved. Social construction, using and doing some of this research and talking to a dear friend who is an economist, and we talked about identity, and had to really kind of explore this notion of social construction of identity beyond demographics, beyond, you know, my age, my gender, my household income, you know, my two kids, but to really understand the different identities and how those are socially constructed and presented and received in the context of a dialogue. And then finally, it was very interesting to watch and see how these identities came from being more of an individual to more shared. So it was kind of interesting watching how this kind of privileged knowledge and personal experience kind of played out. Obviously, anytime you have 120 people, you're going to have those who have experience of the healthcare and healthcare delivery. You know, an insurance person, somebody who works as a case manager for the Medicaid agency, a nurse. So you're going to have different people with different experience. And it was very interesting amongst the groups, this notion of privileged knowledge and at the same time creating a shared identity that wasn't based on the privileged knowledge. It was based on this notion of you're all here not because you have expertise, but because you're citizens, because you vote. And because you have an interest in community and socially what happens. Okay, so they had this notion of privileged knowledge and personal experience and creating this shared identity that allowed them to ask for the expertise, gee, you're a nurse, clarify this point here, how does this happen? Versus if a person who was a case manager or worked for an insurance company said, well, because of my experience, this is what we should do. And that was not well received by the group. It was like, fine if we ask you for your expertise, but don't take your expertise as meaning that your opinion or your preference is more important than mine. And it was interesting how to see how those kind of arguments then, based on that kind of privileged knowledge, were not accepted. And then finally was this notion of competing narratives, of definitions of equity. Does equity mean that people should have equal access, or that those who have the wherewithal should be able to pay more and have preferred access? So it was very interesting how they all agreed that equity and that these other concepts were important, but oftentimes had very different kind of definitions of them and how those would kind of compete and then be reconciled. So the final thing here in this last minute, looking at a conceptual framework for how deliberative outcomes are kind of achieved and what's happening. Again, started with that personal experience, current knowledge, and added to that the new information. That's when we gauged their preferences. So they all had the same kind of new factual, actuarial, expensive information in their own experience and knowledge. Then went into this center section, which was the dialogue itself, where they had this very kind of egalitarian process, they had balanced content, and they brought their own identities to it as citizens. And from that kind of created some shared meaning and understanding, which kind of then shifted both their individual and thus kind of their aggregate preferences. Obviously, a lot more work to be done here, kind of identifying these kinds of concepts and things to explore further in deliberative forums, but really seeing that and talking to them about 3 months later in a final stakeholder dialogue, that they were very stable, but having been through this process, having worked through these trade-offs of how are we going to cover everybody, how are we going to afford this, what do we think is fair, what do we think is equitable, what do we think also trades on these underlying values of personal responsibility, we see the same kind of stability in the judgments and the conclusions that they came to. Would be interesting to go back now, it's been about a year and a half, to test and see how stable that continues to be as things continue to evolve and change. But also, obviously, like I said, a lot more to unpack and look at here. So the disclosure slides, no relationships. I was working for a foundation at the time. They actually funded the forums and allowed me to use this for some. They were interested in the outcome. They wanted to know what the preferences were. They kindly allowed me to use the data to see why and how that happened. And again, more information about the dialogues, slhi.org, or questions for me, I am now at pdx.edu. So, questions? Here and then in the back.
First of all, thank you for restoring my faith in reasoned arguments.
It's amazing. They were
most places that I know of, most countries where meaningful healthcare reform was achieved, the notion that healthcare is a basic human right was a stepping stone in that. Did that ever figure in the arguments that you had in your group?
As a healthcare right, yes, they saw it as really the major underlying values here, and this might be a uniquely American kind of thing, were these notions of personal responsibility and equity. But it was very interesting with some of the arguments about personal responsibility. If they talked about items that were, there was one who had a kid who played football, and so somebody said, you know, you don't want to cover personal responsibility, and yet there are things that people do that are dangerous, particularly with the financing. The sin taxes were in immediately, obviously, for smoking and alcohol, and somebody said, well, you know, what about bungee jumping? What about riding a motorcycle with no helmet? What about, you know, and so it's like, how do you tax, how do you do these other things? So this notion of personal responsibility is a huge, particularly maybe uniquely American kind of theme, but they were trying to balance with this notion of equity, which they defined very differently. The people who, about 75% of the people who preferred the public option defined equity as everybody should be entitled to the same level of health care, whereas people who preferred market-oriented kind of options tended much more strongly to prefer a definition of equity that said that people who can pay more should be able to buy something better. If I can afford it, that's where I want to spend my money, why shouldn't I be able to do that? And that as being a definitions of equity. So really kind of surfacing and reconciling some of those, which again, may be kind of uniquely American. Yes.
First, I want to thank you. My name is Omar Martinez, and I was wondering, you talk about the fact that you had a representative sample.
Mm-hmm.
If you had any undocumented participants in the study, and how does that affect the construct of the liberty and democracy, for example, political judgment, participation? How does that affect, and if you had any narrative, can you bring in a narrative of these undocumented participants if you had some in your study?
If there were some people who were participating here who were undocumented?
Yes.
I don't know if they were documented or not. The demographics that we matched were age, gender, health status, insurance coverage, political affiliation. So we knew that we kind of covered those bases. We did not ask about immigration status.
Don't you think that has an effect on the way you define the constructs of political?
It might have been. I know that we also did cover race ethnicity, but amongst those in Arizona, obviously about 30% of the population is Hispanic, Latino, but not asking about documentation status, we don't know about that. That is one part. And so that might have a difference. It was interesting that in one of the forums, the one in Phoenix, there was a woman who was very much the whole problem with ED overcrowding, the whole health system, is undocumented immigrants. And it was very interesting that she really, I would have to say, marginalized herself and her argument because it was not seen as reasoned and credible by the others because of the kind of extreme language or rhetoric with which she presented it and continued, even in the face of people talking about other reasons why access to health care was something that kind of transcended immigration status. And so she became, I would say, really not at all influential in the group. So, yeah. Any questions?
Last question.
Last one.
Basic question about the demographics of the participants. I was just wondering if you could give us a real general overview of like what percent male, female race, if you had that.
Oh yeah, they really matched the demographics. They were done in the three major areas, Phoenix area, Maricopa County, Tucson, which is a little more heavily Hispanic, probably about 35%. It's probably about 28% or so in the Phoenix area. And then in the northern part of the state up in Flagstaff, where we have a little higher Native American participation because of the tribal areas that are there, but usually within about a couple of percentage points. And the participants were recruited through a polling firm. And so we specifically recruited participants to have that broad demographic representation. And then again, like I said, paid the stipend so that we didn't lose the high income.
Did you also look at educational attainment and socioeconomic status of participants when you were trying to match the demographics?
Yes. Yes, and found some, and I'm trying to think. Yeah, so we had that in the questionnaire, in the post-dialogue questionnaire, we asked a lot of those questions about perception of the health system and other things, and so we had that in there, and I'm sorry, I don't recall running analysis to see how educational attainment and income, which tend to vary.
Yeah, I just wonder how those two things might have influenced the shift in attitudes from private to public.
Yeah. Our median income of the group was very close to the median income, within a couple thousand dollars, 42 versus 45 or 46. So we were pretty close. And we were just a tad on the high end, so we might have been missing just a little bit on the lower end, which would correlate to maybe missing a little bit on the lower end of the education scale. Sorry.
Do you have a summary report of your findings?
Yes, there are summary reports on the SLHI.org website. Some of this was published on there, so not on the how stuff, but on the outcome stuff. If you're interested in the kind of underlying how did this happen stuff, you can contact me. If you're interested in the outcome, there are two publications. They're a little hard to find, but they are on the website. It's work that was done about, probably about 2 years ago. you go back into the publications and research reports, and you can find there's a real short little synopsis and then a little more in-depth report.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.